When Shel Silverstein wrote this poem, he seemed to know that someday he'd be gone, but children would still be smiling with him.
Years from now, although I cannot see your face as you flip these poems a while, somewhere from some far-off place I hear you laughing and I smile.
That was 8-year-old Claire Filatko reading Years From Now. It's one of the poems in a new book called Everything On It that Silverstein's family has just released. If you liked Silverstein's other books, Light in the Attic, Where the Sidewalk Ends, you'll know this as Vintage Shell.
Happy birthday. So what if nobody came? I'll have all the ice cream and tea. And I'll laugh with myself. And I'll dance with myself. And I'll sing happy birthday to me.
There are kids underneath my bed, cried little baby monster Fred. Mama Monster smiled. Oh, Fred, there's no such thing as kids, she said.
That first poem, Happy Birthday, was read by 9-year-old Trenise Jones. The second poem, Frightened, was read by 7-year-old Paul Osterman Healy. Both of those poems are in the new collection, Everything On It. The book has 145 poems in all. Silverstein eliminated many of them from his earlier books, not because he didn't like them. They just didn't happen to fit in the perfect order he was looking for in a given collection. The editor of the new book, Tony Marquette, worked on other projects alongside Silverstein before Silverstein died in 1999. Marquette says the poet paid attention to every last detail.
He would move a piece of art over an 18th of an inch and look at it, how it looked on a page.
Wow, a slight adjustment.
Yeah, it's a slight adjustment, but to him, it mattered. And I think one of the reasons his books are still so immensely popular after almost 50 years is that every tiny detail was considered.
Well, in putting together this new book, I mean, was Shel sort of in your head? I mean, if you made a slight adjustment, you'd say, my God, he's a perfectionist. He would want me to do this or that.
Well, you know, I worked with the family, Shel's family, and they knew him obviously much better than I did. You know, we had the previous three poetry books, so we had a template of how he liked to pace things out, because pacing and balance was everything to him.
Pacing and balance. What do you mean by that?
Well, when you read a book like this, as you read any book, any adult book, the right-hand side has to want to make you turn the page, page after page after page. And balance of the poems, you know, he has some extremely funny poems in all of the books. He has some more poignant poems. He has some naughty poems. And
sure
I think he liked to mix it up so that a child or any reader would never be bored. And you could let it open at any page and you would be entertained and you wouldn't feel that you were coming out of nowhere. And so these are his poems. This is his art. We didn't do anything to them. We simply chose them out of the ones that had not had a chance to be published yet.
How did you choose the title, Everything On It? Why that poem?
If you look at his other books, the title was part of the artwork. I mean, to him, typography and layout was part of the whole. And so the art is wonderful. I mean, you look at it and you wonder, what is he doing with all that stuff on a hot dog? And it makes
and
you want to turn.
It's a boy holding a hot dog with everything you can imagine piled on it up sky high, a basketball hoop, a snake,
everything.
A hat, an umbrella, yeah.
Which is what happens when you ask for a hot dog with everything on it. So we laid out a few. We did layouts of a few others. And this was the one that we felt if you were walking into any of the bookstores and this was on a wall, it would draw your eye the most clearly.
Let's get to Italian food.
Oh.
You said the family really likes this poem. Why is that?
Well, they liked me reading the poem. Italian food. Oh, how I love Italian food. I eat it all the time, not just because how good it tastes, but because how good it rhymes. Minestrone, cannelloni, maccheroni, rigatoni, spaghettini, scaloppini, escarole, bracciole, insalata, cremolata, manicotti, marinara, carbonara, shrimp francese, bolognese, ravioli, mostaccioli, mozzarella, tagliatelle, fried zucchini, rollatini, fettuccini, green linguini, tortellini, tetrazzini. Oops. I think I split my genies.
It was my condition to agree to the interview if Tony was allowed to read Italian food.
That last voice is Mitch Myers. He's Shel Silverstein's nephew, and he helps run his uncle's estate. He did insist that Tony read that poem, Italian Food, in our interview. In fact, reading Shel's verses aloud was a big part of how they put this collection together.
We had a number of poems in the excess of 1,500.
How did you whittle it down to 145?
Well, all the members of the team got a copy or a collection of the poems. We all went through them individually first and picked out the ones that we liked, the maybes and the no's. We met once a month for about a year, and we went through all of the poems that we had in our list. And if it made it through that crowd, then it was a keeper. We believe and like to think that poems need to be read out loud, and this is one of the joys of the book, and we really were able to determine if it really worked when we said it out loud. And even if we already agreed that it was a yes and was a keeper, the next time around, we still read it.
And who's we? Who was in the who was on the committee?
Well, the family. We all are behind this big dark curtain. And,
are we talking about 20 people? Five people?
About five of us.
One of the people behind that curtain was Mitch's mom, Shell's sister. She was on the line, too.
You want to read the title poem?
I'm going to start with the title poem, Everything on It.
Sounds good.
Everything on It. I asked for a hot dog with everything on it, and that was my big mistake. Because it came with a parrot, a bee in a bonnet, a wristwatch, a wrench, and a rake. It came with a goldfish, a flag, and a fiddle, a frog, and a front porch swing, and a mouse in a mask. That's the last time I asked for a hot dog with everything.
All right, that's Peg Myers, who is Shel Silverstein.
Oh, I have one more, David.
Peggy, it is all, the floor is yours.
Okay, this is called Dirty Clothes. Some put them in a washer, some toss them in a tub. Some dump them in a laundry truck for someone else to scrub. Some stick them in a hamper, some stuff them in a sack. I never worry about them, I just keep them on my back.
Well, there you have it. Shel Silverstein's sister, Peg Myers, along with her son, Mitch. Shel's new book of poetry, Everything on It, is on bookshelves today. You can read some of the verses at our website, npr.org. We will leave you now with Paul Osterman Healy reading the final poem in Shel's new collection.
When I am gone. When I am gone, what will you do? Who will write and who will draw? Who will write and who will draw for you? Someone smarter, someone new, someone better, maybe you.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Greene.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Some people wake up in the morning and thank God for granting them another day. Others get up and thank their genes, their frontal cortex, and their lipids. Secular thinking has a long history, longer than many of us knew. Here's NPR science correspondent Robert Krulwich.
Way back when he was just 17 years old, and this was years and years before he became a literature professor at Harvard and author of the bestseller Will in the World about Shakespeare, Stephen Greenblatt was standing in his college bookstore. His exams were over, the summer beckoned, and as he looks around...
Something catches my eye.
There, sitting in a bin, was a little book.
It was for sale for 10 cents.
Yeah, but the thing that got his attention was the cover.
Exactly.
It showed two pairs of naked legs intertwined.
In what appears to be an intimate position.
The title, on the other hand, looked kind of straight. On the Nature of Things by some ancient Roman named Lucretius. But because of the cover...
I bought it.
And when he opened it, it started with a hymn or a poem.
About how in the spring all animals are excited with the impulse to regenerate. Anyway, it goes on.
This is
on
getting good then, is what I...
Yeah, it goes on in this really wonderful and powerful vein.
But when the poem ends and the book takes a turn to science and starts to describe how the world is put together, then Stephen was totally wowed.
My jaw dropped.
But why? What did he say?
Well, what he says is that the world doesn't need any creator. The universe is made up out of an infinite number of atoms.
And people and dogs, rocks, stars. Everything is made from the same stuff. So humans are not special. We don't have souls. And if we do, when we die...
The soul would dissolve as well. So that there would be absolutely no afterlife.
No heaven, no hell, just random collections of atoms clumping together over vast spells of time.
And emptiness, void, and nothing else.
Whoa. When did Lucretius write this?
More than 2,000 years ago.
What do you know about him?
Zilch, nada, virtually.
Only that he lived in Rome and that this book of his?
Is the only one.
But in its day...
This poem was quite famous.
50 years before Jesus, many Romans probably had copies of Lucretius in their libraries. Then comes the rise of the Christian church. When church fathers read this poem, they thought...
What?
Where is our story?
Where were the angels? Where were the demons? Where was Jesus Christ? That world didn't have room any longer for a vision of atoms and emptiness and nothing else. Mm-hmm. So Lucretius basically goes underground, disappears.
His books made of papyrus get lost, get eaten by insects.
So what was once a fairly widespread text becomes much less familiar and then less familiar and less familiar until, in the case of Lucretius, they might have been reduced to something like 2-3 copies, let's imagine, in existence.
So if this poem, with all its novel ideas, is going to make it through to the Renaissance, it would have to be hand-copied by monks in monasteries every few hundred years. So the book is now hanging by a thread.
Absolute thread. And then it just depends. It's a pure matter of accident, because no one at this point is interested in keeping it alive any more than...
Well, let's have our accident. Let's have our accident. Who else? Poggio Bracciolini. I don't know, is that how you say it?
That is Poggio Bracciolini. You can think of Silvia Poggioli and just shorten it to Poggio
Bracciolini. You are a public
Bracciolini
radio type, aren't you?
Of course. So there are a group of people, let's say around the year 1400.
And one of them is Poggio Bracciolini, who lived near Florence.
He was a poor kid. He came with, he says, 5 pennies in his pocket to Florence. But he has a peculiar gift, which is that he has fantastically good handwriting.
And that gift got him his jobs with the Pope.
That's where the money is.
And that's where the intrigue and the corruption and the violence are. At one point, Poggio gets into a fight with another secretary and he tries to gouge out his eye.
Well, the other guy was holding his testicles at the time. I mean, they were having a fight. They all hated each other.
This sounds awful.
And so it was a good place to lose your soul, as it were.
But on his bad days, and he had a lot of them, Poggio had a way to escape. He would imagine beautiful, elegant, classic works from ancient Rome, filled with noble thoughts, lost books, waiting somewhere to be rescued. And he had this desire, says Steve,
to find those lost books.
And so Poggio, in his spare time, he became a book hunter. And in the winter of 1417...
He has time on his hands.
So he heads off to Germany, where there are still monasteries.
Ancient monasteries with libraries that hadn't been searched yet.
And then?
One day, he finds himself somewhere. I think it was Fulda.
In Germany. And he, in effect, knocks on the monastery door and he asks for entry.
And he goes into the library and he finds it.
Our book. Looking
around. Completely random. He hasn't a clue what he's going to find.
But somehow, after 1,000 years, against all odds, sitting on a shelf, here it is.
On the Nature of Things. And he must have recognized the name.
Because Poggio immediately ordered a copy made and then made another in his beautiful handwriting.
And he sent it back to a friend of his, Niccolò Niccoli. And that act of making a copy of the copy of the copy of the copy
brought it back to life. First, it was passed
very, very quietly
to certain households in Florence. Then it shows up in Bologna and then in Paris. And people begin to talk of universes emerging from atoms, wondering,
what if that were possible?
It's not possible, says the church, and the book is banned, first in schools and then in Florence. But Machiavelli, in his own hand, makes himself a private copy. And now Shakespeare notices, and then Montaigne in France writes essay after essay about Lucretius.
Molière did a translation.
And Thomas Jefferson had 5 copies of Lucretius in his library. They, all of them, borrowed from Lucretius, this radically secular thinker. Though his poem is now more than 2,000 years old, even today.
It's dangerous. It's radioactive. It's dangerous to touch it.
It describes a universe with no author and no purpose, but of such exquisite complexity.
It's unbelievably beautiful. It's written in just magnificent poetry.
That says even if there is no heaven and no loving God, no design, no reason for us to be here, as painful as that may seem, says Lucretius, look around. What is here is more than good. It's amazing and it's beautiful.
I think that there is a deep truth to that perception. And I think that what Lucretius offers still after 2,000 years, more than 2,000 years, is an incentive to take this news not as pain, but as pleasure, not as disillusionment, but as illusionment, but as wonder.
Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
Stephen Greenblatt's new book is The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. You can read an excerpt at NPR.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Green.
Roger Ebert is best known for expanding the place of film criticism on TV. For his thumb, of course. and for his cancer, which has left him unable to speak. He remains active as a critic and blogger. Ebert and his wife Chaz have been producing a new version of the show At the Movies, with two young critics talking about films, like Ebert and the late Gene Siskel once did. Now Roger Ebert has a new memoir called Life Itself. Our critic-at-large John Powers has a review.
You can divide famous people into two broad categories: those who find fame a burden, and those who take it like a tonic. Roger Ebert is one of the latter. That rarest of creatures, a film critic who everyone knows, he really enjoys being Roger Ebert. This pleasure comes through in his new memoir, Life Itself. Perhaps goaded into existence by the cancer that has assailed him in recent years, it tells the life story of the man with the most famous thumb in America, pausing along the way to offer the author's views on everything from the glories of black and white cinematography to the existence of God to the comedy of being fat. The book is chatty, upbeat, and structurally loose, which is to say that it sounds exactly like Roger Ebert. He was born 69 years ago in Urbana, Illinois, and enjoyed a classic middle American childhood, idyllic but tinged with darkness. He had an electrician father, Walter, whom he obviously adored, and a mother, Annabelle, who treated him kindly but also scared him with her anger, especially once she became an alcoholic, a drinking problem that Ebert himself would share and eventually conquer. A lifelong liberal, Ebert had dreamed of being a feisty newspaper columnist like Mike Royko. But his life took a very different turn in 1967, when, much to his surprise, he was named film critic for the Chicago Sun-Times. He was all of 25 years old, and he seized the job like a brass ring. His career took off quickly. He'd won the Pulitzer Prize by age 33, and he began accumulating a vast storehouse of anecdotes. He gives career advice to the young Oprah Winfrey, hangs out with the old Robert Mitchum, and scripts the movie Beyond the Valley of the Dolls for skinflick meister Russ Meyer, whose own account of their collaboration makes you suspect that Ebert is giving us the PG version. Still, he would have remained a minor local celebrity had it not been for the 1975 creation of the movie review show Sneak Previews, with fellow Chicago critic Gene Siskel, a competitive man of burning ambition, whom Ebert portrays with surprising generosity. The show wasn't Ebert's idea, but it changed him and our culture, not always for the best. The trademark feature of Sneak Previews was that moment when Ebert and Siskel gave movies thumbs up or thumbs down, a hugely influential shtick that reduced film criticism to a simple-minded consumer guide in which ideas barely matter. Yet while I know scads of critics who dislike that show, I'm not sure I know any who dislike or blame Ebert. They think that's just Roger. And Roger has never been one of those critics you read for his analysis. He's a critic you read for his openness and enthusiasm. Because of that enthusiasm, you might almost say that he's the original fanboy. Breezy, personal, ready to share. This may help explain why, after cancer forced him from his TV show, he reinvented himself as a hugely successful blogger, weighing in on everything from movies to politics to what he sees as the ruination of his newspaper by idiots. It's probably the best writing he's ever done. And it's all the more impressive because life dealt him a hard blow with a disease that keeps him from eating, drinking, or talking, three things he obviously loved. But rather than sinking into a funk or hiding away, he's gone on with his life. And one of the many admirable features of his new book is its sunniness. It's wholly free from the complaining and self-pity so popular in memoirs these days. That's just what you'd hope for from a guy who was raised and thrived in the very heart of the American century. Ebert is anything but provincial. Life Itself begins with a reference to Ingmar Bergman's film Persona and ends by quoting Tintin's dog, Milou. But reading this book, I was struck by how deeply he's inscribed with our national character. The decency and good humor and happy acceptance of other cultures. The recognition that the world has murky depths he just as soon not dwell on. Above all, the eagerness to engage with life. You see, unlike a lot of film critics, Roger Ebert knows that there's more to living than just sitting in the dark.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed Life Itself, a memoir by Roger Ebert. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show.
Writer Atish Tasir's father, a Pakistani governor, was murdered by a religious fundamentalist earlier this year. The author's brother has since been kidnapped. Tasir writes about this kind of violent and turbulent Pakistan in his new novel, Noon. The author's own connection with the country is complicated. He first came to know his father's Pakistan while growing up in New Delhi with his Indian mother. The novel is largely based in a fictional Pakistani city, a place beset by Islamist extremism. Atish Tasir joined us from our New York bureau, and he began by reading this passage from Noon.
There were green turbans, brown turbans, and red turbans. There were 6 inches and 12 inches, depending on which relationship between piety and the length of your beard you believed in. There were Shias and Sunnis, of course, but among them, too, there were innumerable divisions and subdivisions. And these groups, each in their highly particular way, despised one another. They planted bombs at each other's meetings, they rioted at the slightest provocation, they dug themselves into breeze block ghettos that stretched for miles along the periphery of the city.
You paint a picture of a very busy, incendiary place, it sounds like, with a lot of division.
Right, and also that sense of where the religion, which has been what the state was founded on, is distorted to suit everyone's particular end.
Well, let's step back a little bit. Your brother, Shahbaz Tasir, a businessman in Lahore, was kidnapped at the end of last month and hasn't been heard from since. I mean, do you know anything about his whereabouts that you can tell us?
No, frankly, I don't. There have been a series of kidnappings in Pakistan, and it seems one of the theories that people put forward is that these are groups, Islamic groups, that are running out of money, and one of the ways that they get money is that they organize these kidnappings in Pakistan, and this is the way that these groups are now filling their coffers.
Well, your father was the governor of Punjab, the largest province in Pakistan. He was killed by his own bodyguard for being very outspoken in fighting Pakistan's blasphemy law. Do you sense or see a connection between his death and your brother's kidnapping?
I hope not, because if there is a connection, then that's the most scary scenario. If in any way it's linked, because there's been, since my father died, there's been cycle after cycle. There was a celebration of his killer. There were the lawyers who came forward to defend the killer. There were great posters of his killer around the city of Lahore. And so it's been this environment has been created where it's been almost impossible to try his killer. And there's a huge amount of public support for what the killer did. So much so that my first book, Stranger to History, had been used in court to basically put forward the idea that my father was in some ways not as pious or as religious as they wanted him to be. And because of the kind of place that Pakistan is at the moment, it's possible to make the case that someone, because he's not religious in the way you want him to be, well, it's all right for him to be killed.
You say your own words from your last book are being used by people in Pakistan to say that your father should have been killed.
And that's the kind of place that Pakistan is at the moment, that there are judges willing to hear that there are lawyers who feel that they can make that case in a court of law. And it's obviously a pretty hideous thing to be suggesting.
I want to ask you, your father was opposed to a blasphemy law, and I know he was defending a Christian woman. What exactly does the law say that your father was opposed to?
The law is an absolute absurdity. It's a law that means, like, David and I could have a conversation today. I could go to the court right after the conversation because perhaps there's something that you've said that I haven't liked, and I say, this man has committed blasphemy. Someone would come and arrest you, and what the law became was an instrument for a majority to oppress the minorities. It became a very high number of Hindus, Christians who were in jail for this law. And so for my father, that it should be used to terrorize a country's minorities would have been particularly horrible. And it was against those laws that he was speaking out. And this became twisted to in some way suggest that he was guilty of blasphemy.
You had a difficult relationship with your father. When he was killed, you hadn't spoken to him in a couple years.
Yeah.
How has his death sort of shaped your memories of him?
My differences with my father were differences, intellectual differences, his political differences. I wrote and spoke about Pakistan in a way that he didn't like. I often didn't agree with his assessment of the country, but there were things that I never doubted about him. I never doubted his love of his country or his courage. And I'm pretty proud of what he did. You know, whatever acrimony or difficulty we had is very small compared to what I feel he's been able to do for his country.
What does his death and what does the fact that people are calling his killer a hero say about Pakistan today?
I think that it says that this ideology that we thought was limited to a few, that we thought was in some way had no traction among the population of Pakistan, well, one fears that it seeped very deep, that this kind of religiosity, this kind of ugly fanaticism is much deeper than we thought. And it's very worrying because to get rid of a regime or to get rid of a government that's playing with religion is, as you've seen recently in the Arab world, is no great thing. But to root out this kind of sentiment from a population is a far more difficult thing.
You write in your novel, and we should say that Noon is a novel. It's not a memoir. It's a fictional novel. But you address some of the religious thoughts, fanaticism, starting to make their way into the minds of a younger generation in Pakistan.
Yeah. You know, this novel was written before my father was killed. And so there are vibrations of what's happened this year in the novel. It seems that it anticipated some of the things that have happened this year. I think it anticipated the violence that's widespread in the society, the violence that's not simply jihadi violence or Islamic violence. There's a kind of a general sense of a society disintegrating. I think it also anticipates the kind of absurdity of fanaticism, of people making sort of prisons for the mind, which make the world sort of easier to deal with. They sort of narrow your worldview, and then the world becomes less fearful when you see it through the lens of that very simple idea, you know?
I don't want to give too much away from the novel, but there are, you know, violent mobs in your book. There's a scene of torture, and I guess I just wonder, given your father's murder, given that your brother's been kidnapped, is it difficult to read these passages now?
I think it's all difficult. It's all difficult because it represents a kind of violence that I think of as very real in Pakistan. And to have seen that violence come so clearly to the surface in this last year, I'd had an intimation of it when I was last in Pakistan. And I think I probably wrote with that intimation of violence in mind. All of that's very disturbing. It's very chilling for me to read it now in light of what has happened this year.
Atish, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
That's Atish Tasir. He's author of the new novel, Noon. Some residents of upstate New York have been seeing this ad recently. It warns that the state's water supply is headed for ruin.
New York tap water has always been the best in the world.
I love my New York water.
In places where gas companies are already using a dangerous process called fracking, like Pennsylvania, the water is cloudy and full of toxic chemicals.
This ad is part of an intensifying debate over fracking. That's the process energy companies use to get a certain kind of natural gas out of the ground. And it's one of the many subjects covered in a new book by Daniel Yergin. In The Quest, Yergin writes about the ongoing search for sustainable forms of energy. The type of natural gas they're looking for in New York State wasn't even a serious energy source for the U.S. until recently.
Shale gas really has been a revolution. It's happened extremely rapidly. Up until 2008, it really wasn't recognized, and then it just took off, and it's gone from being virtually none of our natural gas production to about 30% of our total natural gas production.
In the United States?
In the United States.
That's so big that fracking for shale gas is reshaping energy policy in the U.S., but it's also raising a lot of concerns about all that drilling. Yergin sits on a Department of Energy committee that's investigating the environmental impact.
One of the things we need is good scientific data about what does it mean for water. Can there be a migration? Because, of course, the fracking is occurring at a much, much lower level beneath impermeable rock. And is that going to be the source of if there is methane in the water? Or the other key question is, what does it mean for air pollution when you start bringing generators into the area and so forth? And the industry itself knows that these are issues that it has to deal with. And so I think we're going to see a lot of innovation and a lot of progress to address environmental questions around this.
Of course, these questions are new to states like New York and Pennsylvania, where fracking is taking place. We're not talking about Texas, where people are more accustomed to energy development. People in the Northeast have been going through a tough transition.
We see that happening in the state of New York now, where Governor Cuomo opened the door to shale gas production in some of the really poor regions of the state and sees it in terms of economic development.
Jobs.
Jobs. You know, it comes down to employment. Shale gas has created hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of jobs in the last 5 years in the United States. It's brought $1 billion of revenue into the state government of Pennsylvania. It's no question that you go into more populated, more people there, and suddenly a lot of trucks appear. There's a lot of development in the area, and it kind of does have a transformative impact.
The culture really changes in a way. I mean, when you're talking about so many more people working in the energy sector and the trucks, as you say, the traffic.
It's the traffic. I mean, I think that those are part of the reason for the response to it. So, you know, this is a great resource. This is the biggest energy innovation probably in the last 30 years that we've seen. But it has to be done in a way that is both environmentally responsible and also acceptable to the public.
You can understand why Juergen thinks this is such a big innovation if you listen to President Obama. Just this March, Mr. Obama touted how there could be a century's worth of shale gas beneath our feet in the U.S. That could give the U.S. a measure of security, reducing that dependence on foreign sources of energy. But the move to shale gas in the U.S. has implications for the whole world.
My personal quest in writing the quest was to try and provide a framework to see how these things all tie together. Indeed, it has become increasingly interconnected. And so if you wind the clock back to 2008, the United States was going to be a huge importer of liquefied natural gas from the Middle East, from countries like Trinidad, from Angola, from Nigeria, maybe from Russia. That's all off the table because we're now self-sufficient in terms of natural gas. And suddenly that gas that was going to come in cargoes and ships to the United States has to find other destinations.
You tie things together with shale gas. I mean, there's less need for liquefied natural gas in the United States. That means there's more available in Europe. That means perhaps less reliance on Russia. So to tie those pieces together.
Well, it's one domino falls after another. So liquefied natural gas that was going to go to the United States because tens of billions of dollars had been invested in it, no home in the United States. So it was going to Europe. That meant lower demand for Russian gas. But then something else happened somewhere else in the world, this awful, terrible accident at Fukushima
in Japan.
What was going to be the nuclear renaissance is now a much, much, much more uncertain thing. The German Chancellor Merkel, who was a big advocate for stepping up the nuclear program in Germany, changes her mind really and says, well, we can't do it. We're going to shut down our nuclear power. What does that mean? They'll import more natural gas. Where will they import it from? Russia.
And so, like dominoes, one country changing its energy strategy can set off reverberations around the world. And, of course, the availability of a new resource can raise questions about a country's energy policy. Take the U.S. With so much shale gas available over the next 100 years, should the U.S. even bother to keep developing renewables? Juergen says yes.
We need to focus on renewables to start with for security reasons, for diversification reasons. And I go back to what Winston Churchill, when he was head of the British Royal Navy, said before World War I, when he was converting the Royal Navy from safe British coal to oil from Persia, Iran. And people said, this is really dangerous. And he said, safety in oil lie in variety and variety alone. And I think that's still a fundamental starting point.
I'm interested that you use the term energy security as a reason to keep some focus on renewables, even if we have this shale gas breakthrough. Why is that? Are you concerned that our shale gas infrastructure might be hit by enemies?
Well, I just think in principle that one of the sub-themes of the book is surprise. You know what's going to happen, and everybody agrees on what's going to happen, and then something else happens, and it could be everything from political crises, as we've seen, that affect oil supply, to natural disasters, to technological breakthroughs, and that we have a very complex energy foundation that our $14 trillion economy rests upon. There was a blackout recently in Southern California and Arizona, and one of the executives said, we never imagined that all these things would happen at the same time. And I just think in general with energy, given how important it is to our economy, we need to be diversified. You know, one of the big challenges we have is the growth of demand on a global basis. There isn't one single solution that provides the answer.
That's Daniel Juergen. He's author of the new book, The Quest. His last book, The Prize, won the Pulitzer Prize.
So Daniel Yergin argues for diverse sources of energy, and a report this week is forecasting that we are on our way to more diversity than we have now.
The U.S. Energy Information Administration predicts where the world will get its energy over the next 25 years.
Many nations are encouraging the use of renewable energy, and assuming they continue those policies, renewable energy will be the world's fastest growing energy source.
So we'll use a lot more energy from sources like wind and solar panels, but at the same time, the world will demand more energy. The growing economies of China and India will drive that demand.
So even after all those years of renewable energy growth, the forecast says the world will still depend on fossil fuels for about 3/4 of our energy use.
Harvard professor Stephen Greenblatt extended his reach far beyond academic readers with Will in the World, his best-selling 2004 book about Shakespeare's life. Will in the World was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award. Greenblatt has just published a new book called The Swerve. After reading it, our book critic Maureen Carrigan was inspired to say, "Move over, Will Shakespeare. A craze for the Roman poet Lucretius is about to begin." Here's her review.
The latest distress signal being sounded on the chat sites I share with my bookish friends is that IKEA is about to introduce an updated version of its classic Billy bookcase, some 10 of which totter to overflowing in my own basement. Anticipating the death of the book, IKEA has redesigned the good old Billy with deeper shelves and glass doors, thus transforming it from a bookcase into a tchotchke cabinet. What a relief, then, it's been to escape from this most recent alarmist speculation into, what else, a book that itself attests to the power of books, or in this case, a single book, to change the world. Stephen Greenblatt's new nonfiction wonder, called The Swerve, is part adventure tale, part enthralling history of ideas. As Greenblatt's story reminds us, there have been other, much grimmer times in history when books as objects very nearly disappeared, without Kindles, Nooks, or iPads to take their place. At the center of The Swerve is the forgotten story of a 15th-century Italian book hunter named Poggio Bracciolini, who set out on several expeditions throughout monasteries on the continent and England, hoping to discover some lost classical texts. Poggio served as scribe and secretary in the papal court, a place he cynically thought of as the lie factory. But his passion was for books, especially for the ancient authors, copies of whose books, if they survived at all, had been squirreled away in monasteries. One of the startling pieces of information Greenblatt shares with the lay reader is just how few classical works managed to crawl into the Middle Ages. Greenblatt tells us that, apart from some charred papyrus fragments recovered from a villa near Pompeii, there are no surviving contemporary manuscripts from the ancient Greek and Roman world. Everything that has reached us is a copy, most often very far removed in time, place, and culture from the original. One of the ancients whose works seem to have completely disappeared in what Greenblatt calls the Great Vanishing was the Roman poet Lucretius, whose name was mentioned in some other classical works that did survive. On a fateful January day in 1417, the intrepid Poggio found himself in the library of a German monastery and reached up for a manuscript. It turned out to be the only surviving copy of Lucretius's poem On the Nature of Things, a rich, dangerous, mind-blowing poem written around 50 BCE, whose ideas, Greenblatt says, would jumpstart the Renaissance and lay the groundwork for modernity. Pretty huge claims, but Greenblatt is both scholar and storyteller enough to support them. Among other radical notions, Lucretius, who was a follower of the philosopher Epicurus, claimed that all matter is composed of atoms, that matter is constantly in motion, that human beings return to this cosmic atomic dance when we die, and that there is no religiously sanctioned afterlife, and finally, joy in existence, not suffering or atoning or endurance, is the point of life. Greenblatt says that some of the world shakers who would be directly influenced by Lucretius's ideas are Galileo, Einstein, and our very own American apostle of the pursuit of happiness, Thomas Jefferson. Surely sales of Lucretius's On the Nature of Things will spike as a result of Greenblatt's book. His awestruck discussions of the poem make it sound so weird and beautiful that most readers will want to give Lucretius a whirl themselves. And what a service Greenblatt has performed in bringing to light Poggio Bracciolini, a great explorer who discovered not lost continents, but lost books. The Swerve is one of those brilliant works of nonfiction that's so jam-packed with ideas and stories it literally boggles the mind. But throughout this profusion of riches, it seems to me a moral emerges, something about the fragility of cultural inheritance and how it needs to be consciously safeguarded. Greenblatt, of course, doesn't preach, but as a master storyteller, he transports his readers deep into the ancient and late medieval past. He makes us shiver at his recreation of that crucial moment in a German monastery when modern civilization, as we've come to know it, depended on a swerve of Poggio's grasping fingers.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Swerve, How the World Became Modern by Stephen Greenblatt. I'm Terry Gross.